This hour on Behind the Headlines, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle are uniting against air pollution, proposing a sales tax hike for public transit, cleaner school buses, and incentives for hybrid cars. Will these clean air caucus ideas resonate with the full legislature? Leave liquor laws alone. That's the message this week from top LDS church leaders. Will lawmakers take the advice? Four same-sex couples are taking Utah to court, arguing the stay on gay marriage is unfair, unjust, and illegal. So how will the state respond? And a group of fathers is suing the state as well, saying they were cut out of the adoptions of their children. Do Utah adoption laws unfairly keep dads out of the loop? The week's news, plus Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Stay tuned for Behind the Headlines coming up after the news. Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we're talking air pollution, liquor laws, the ACLU lawsuit on behalf of gay couples, and more. Joining me to talk about the top news stories of the week, Tribune reporters Brian Maffley, who covers environmental issues. Brian, hello.
Hi.
Also coming in, state government reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, great to have you back.
Thank you. Good morning.
And columnist Paul Raleigh, welcome back to you.
Good morning.
And you can join us as well. How has air pollution affected you this week? What do you think the LDS Church statement on liquor laws means for the upcoming legislative session? Any other stories on your mind, you can send your questions and comments to the hashtag TribTalk on Twitter and Google+. Put them in the comments section of our website at sltrib.com or call us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Brian, I'll start with you. A bipartisan group of lawmakers calling themselves the Clean Air Caucus. That has kind of a nice ring to it. Who are they and why are they joining forces?
Sure. Well, I think there's a recognition among many in the legislature that their constituents are unhappy about the air quality, even though it's not as bad, supposedly, as 20 years ago. People have clearly run out of patience, as a lot of our polling is showing, and we'd like to see greater leadership on the part of the state. And I think a lot of members of the legislature, Republican and Democrat, are responding to that. The primary leader of this caucus, I would say, is Democrat from Mill Creek, Patrice Arendt. She's sponsoring maybe five of those bills that got unveiled on Wednesday, of 15. And I think the biggest ones are very focused on, you know, helping people do the right things in terms of taking public transit or getting a cleaner automobile. There aren't a lot of bills aimed at tightening up the rules about air quality and what emissions, and you're not going to see any sharp teeth there.
Hmm. What about the money part of this? Is there a willingness or an interest in upping up the sales tax or the gas tax to help fund public transportation?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of proposals for modest increases to sales tax to enable cities to increase their contribution to the Utah Transit Authority. The purpose of that would be to expand bus service. There's a feeling, Ralph Becker, our mayor of Salt Lake City, expressed this yesterday in D.C. There's a feeling that we have expanded rail service, perhaps at the expense of bus service, and we need a better, a more robust system to make sure it's convenient for people to ride. So one of the bills proposed by Joel Briscoe, a Democrat of Salt Lake City, would allow cities like Salt Lake and others to go to their voters and say, would you like to increase the sales tax devoted to transit from the current limit is like 0.6%, not a whole lot, and raise that up to perhaps a full percent.
I'm not sure. Are there numbers attached?
I asked Representative Briscoe that, and he said the fiscal note hasn't been developed yet.
But it's basically just opening the door, saying cities, go ahead, you can do this.
Yes, and he made it very clear to me that this would needs voter approval. It's not something that, you know, the legislature is going to snap its fingers and then you're going to see an increase in the sales tax. sales, any kind of tax increase in Utah is a tough sell, and he really wants to make sure that the voters are on board with it. I think the most significant bill in my mind of those 15 that are getting talked about is the one that's being proposed by Becky Edwards, a Republican of Davis County, who would really like to see this repeal of a prohibition. It must be 30 years old on Utah environmental regulators from adopting standards that are tougher than the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Ralph Becker is also on board with that. I talked to his spokesman yesterday about this very subject, and he agrees. This is such a rule as tying the hands of our environmental regulators, and the way Becky Edwards has talked about it is, well, we need to have rules that are tailored to Utah, not to some federal standard, but stuff that is rules that are reflect our unique situation here, which a lot of it's related to our topography and weather that results in these inversions that are so detrimental to our quality of life.
The people in the Clean Air Caucus obviously feel empowered by the public sentiment, and I imagine they think that they can get these things through. Is there another aspect to this? Is leadership behind any of these bills?
I would say so. Becky Lockhart, the House Speaker, she opened up that press conference the other day and, you know, lauded this group for its bipartisan gesture here. And there was a real recognition that no matter your political point of view, that this is a unifying issue that people from both sides can get on board with. I think where you're going to see disagreements is, well, how far do we go? Do we want it to be regulation-oriented or incentive-oriented? And the governor clearly is responding as well. I mean, everyone wants to see greater leadership from him, and I think he's making the gestures right now, and he wants to, you know, one of the few areas of state spending next year that he wants to increase is money devoted to air quality, you know, open up, you know, create a few new positions at the Division of Air Quality, a substantial investment in retrofitting school buses, the so-called dirty diesel buses that predate 2002. Apparently, there's 170 of them on the roads in Utah, and he would like to see a grant program, like a matching grant program for the school districts to apply for those funds. To apply for those funds to replace their buses and or retrofit them with compressed natural gas, and also to build the infrastructure to service those buses.
Mm. And one of the things, if I may,
yes,
the governor yesterday at his monthly news conference indicated that he'll be focusing pretty prominently on air quality in his State of the State address when he rolls that out on Wednesday of next week. I'm sorry. So he wouldn't give us a hint on what he's going to be proposing. I'm sure he'll feature the things that Brian mentioned about the buses and so forth, but it's going to be a prominent part of his State of the State next week.
Is there the political will, Paul Verrilli, to pass some of these bills, do you think?
Well, you know, the bill Becky, that Brian talked about, Becky Edwards' bill, that would take away this limitation that you talked about. I couldn't have stiffer environmental policies than the EPA. That was tried last year. It didn't get very far. The difference was it was sponsored last year by a Democrat, Rebecca Chavez Hout, and now it's sponsored by a Republican, although she's considered very moderate Republican, and there's that dichotomy. Kind of split in the legislature of kind of a distrust from the more conservative legislators toward moderates. I think they're still going to. There's a strong rural caucus in the legislature of rural legislators who are usually opposed to just about any kind of environmental, you know, regulation or anything, and they're off the Wasatch Front.
But would they support the carrot approach?
Well, we'll see. I don't know. I don't know. I know that they're usually stiff opposition, mostly from the rural legislators who have a lot of power in the legislature and a lot of clout. So we'll see how far it goes. Like I say, last year they tried the same thing, and it didn't go very far at all.
Mm. Yeah, Robert?
Well, tax increases are a tough sell for the legislature, although the way that the Representative Briscoe's has proposed, you know, giving the cities and counties the option to increase the taxes kind of leaves the legislature's hands clean. So in an election year, normally a tax increase would be pretty tough for these, you know, to create these incentives. But giving counties and cities the option, as Salt Lake City has said they want to do, I think it may be a possibility. And the bit about the not having state rules more stringent than federal rules, in particular, that's created an obstacle to the state adopting low sulfur fuel, which could make a pretty significant reduction in tailpipe emissions and could make a difference in the air quality. I mean, as they say, 57%, I think, is the stat they use, that's tailpipe emissions that causes this inversion. And so that's sort of one of the things that would be a direct consequence, I guess, if this bill that Representative Edwards is sponsoring is able to pass the legislature.
The bill, yeah. The committee that will first hear that bill in the House, I believe, is still chaired by Representative Mike Noel of Kane County, who is probably the most fierce opponent of any kind of environmental regulation. And last year when that bill came up, I actually wrote a column about, you know, the way he bullied some witnesses. So we'll see how that plays out again this year.
Speaking with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Paul Raleigh, along with reporters Brian Maffley and Robert Gerke. We're talking about the week's news, and if you want to chime in on the conversation, give us a call, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter to the hashtag TribTalk, or put it in our comment section at sltrib.com. Here's a web comment from Gregory, who writes, recently the LDS Church released a video stating that, in their opinion, the liquor laws in Utah were reasonable. Greg, stay tuned, because we're going to talk about that later in the hour. Greg continues, I'm under no illusion that the LDS faith holds the lion's share of political influence in the Beehive State, but I wonder if this influence couldn't be better served if the brethren were willing to make a statement about the fetid and poisonous air that plagues the valley. Do we see the LDS Church weighing in on the air quality discussion? Robert?
Well, they haven't. I mean, one of the things that was interesting about their liquor statement the other day is that it is fairly unusual for the church to weigh in on one of these issues. But, you know, they also kind of talked about their criteria for when they do get involved, and one of them is what the public health is, you know, at issue. And they also said they're concerned about sort of the culture, I guess, of the where they're headquartered. And so I think they're, you know, based on those criteria, you could envision a scenario where they might get involved in this debate, but they haven't yet. I would be a little surprised. The wheels turn pretty slowly in terms of the church's involvement, and so I would be a little bit surprised to see them actually weigh in on this particular issue.
Brian, all of this talk about air quality comes during a week when Utah had the distinction, I guess that's a nice way of putting it, of having the dirtiest air in the nation. How dirty was it?
Well, I think there were other cities in Southern California, like Bakersfield, whose air quality was slightly worse this week. Right now, we're enjoying a reprieve, thanks to a front that's blown in. But I'm looking at the Division of Air Quality's website at the moment and looking at the trends. And over this week, we were consistently over the federal threshold of 35 micrograms per cubic meter for fine particulate matter. And it hung out for a long time, and it kind of peaked during that press conference that the lawmakers had on Wednesday. And it was, you know, it helped these people make their case to look out across that valley, and you could barely see Mount Olympus. I don't even think you could.
Well, the picture on the front page of the Tribune pretty much told the story there.
Yeah.
Air quality advocates gathering on the Capitol steps tomorrow at noon. Tell us about the rally. They're touting this as the largest rally in the state's history.
That's right. And I guess we'll see when if it really is on Saturday. There's a lot of energy behind the air quality issue these days. Mayor Beckers will be one of the headlining speakers at the event, and also members of some of the activist groups, Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment, I believe Heal Utah, several others. They have coalesced a lot of energy using social media, especially Facebook. One of the activists told me they're reaching 32,000 people just on Facebook alone. They really know how to work these new ways of connecting with people and getting them motivated. I really don't know if 2,000 or 3,000 people is going to be the biggest anti-pollution rally in the state's history, but it sure is going to make a statement. No, there's no question about that. Some of the things Ralph Becker, I hear he's going to talk about, is he wants to develop a program to get make discounted UTA passes available to every resident of Salt Lake City. And I believe he'll be announcing that either tomorrow or very soon. And the idea is people living in Salt Lake City could get a bus pass for $30 a month. That's far less expensive than the retail value, which is I think it's up to 90, but there are a lot of discounts out there. This would be a good one. It's on par with what University of Utah employees would get.
So Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker, of course, making air quality his top priority, the centerpiece of his State of the City address recently. As our colleague Matt Canham reported this morning, the mayor not only has incentives, but he says that the state is an obstacle. He's placing blame at the feet of state officials when it comes to finding solutions to the pollution problem.
Wow.
Paul Raleigh, I'm curious, does that help or hurt? Because I'm thinking of the days of Rocky Anderson when he got very vocal on some issues, and it did seem to be a roadblock when it came to furthering his agenda.
Salt Lake City was definitely punished by the legislature when Rocky Anderson was mayor and kind of ruffled the feathers. Ralph Becker does not have the same kind of brash personality that Rocky Anderson had, and he generally gets along well with the legislature. He was a former minority leader in the House. And he's much more quiet. We'll see how this plays out. But the legislature has shown in the past that if city leaders get too uppity with them, they have ways, budgetary ways of punishing them. I don't know how this is going to play out yet. They usually get along pretty well, have gotten along pretty well with Ralph Becker.
Mm. Thoughts, Brian?
Well, that was really strong language that Mayor Becker used in D.C. Yesterday. And I'm not sure what to make of it, but I think he knows he's got some political wins behind him on this particular issue. It really seems like his administration has focused heavily on improving the air, and we'll see if it's going to influence success on some of this legislation that's coming up. I'd like to point out some of the legislation that's been proposed is really kind of no-brainer stuff that even your most ardent Republican would support. Some of it is very much like deregulation. There's one bill that Patrice Arrant would do, and this would definitely benefit Salt Lake City, is to revise our utility regulations so that a electric vehicle charging station doesn't have to comply with the same regulations as Rocky Mountain Power. It would make it much easier for charging stations to proliferate around the city, therefore making it much easier to own an electrical vehicle.
Mm.
One political reality is that every legislator in Salt Lake City is a Democrat. And the Democrats, basically because of their low numbers in the legislature, have little to no voice or clout. There is not one legislator outside Salt Lake County that is a Democrat. And so, you know, when Ralph Becker takes on the legislature, I mean, there are no legislators up there because I'm talking about Republicans, because they're the ones who have the voice and make all the decisions, that need to worry that much about Ralph Becker in Salt Lake City.
Mm. Right. Robert? Two points on that topic, though. I think we need to look at this air issue outside of just the Salt Lake Valley, because if you look up in Brigham City, if you look in Cache County, if you look in the Uinta Basin, where some of these Republican legislators are from, it's a major problem for them as well. We don't see it here in Salt Lake Valley, but that's where a lot of it is. And so it's not limited to these Democrats in Salt Lake at this point. Plus, as the Tribune poll from a week and a half ago, I guess, is when we ran it out, found there's pretty broad support for doing something to address the air issue. This has become a major public issue, front burner issue. I mean, there have been polls done recently that have found that it's among the top issues in the public's mind as the legislature convenes. And so I think, you know, As Paul mentioned, you see some of these bills that were sponsored by Democrats and failed in the past now being carried by Republicans like Becky Edwards. I think it does make it a lot more likely that we'll see some movement on some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. You know, if I can make one more political point on this, you know, Robert had a very interesting story the other day that talked about the difference between what the public sees as the major issues and what delegates to the Republican convention sees as the major issues. And so while clean air would be polling strongly among the public, the reality in Utah politics is that legislators worry more about, you know, those neighborhood caucuses and who goes to those neighborhood caucuses and who the delegates are. And they might have a whole different set of priorities than the public pertaining to like clean air and other issues like that.
Well, we need to go to a break, but a quick plug for our upcoming town hall meeting. Salt Lake Tribune is sponsoring a public forum, Cleaning Up Utah's Air, next Wednesday, January 29th at 7 o'clock here at the City Library. We'll have a panel of experts, including Bryce Bird, who's the Division of Air Quality Director. We'll have a pulmonologist, Dr. Denitsa Blagev, U of U researcher Carrie Kelly, Sean Tigan from the Utah Foundation. The whole focus is on solutions. What can be done from policymakers down to individuals? You can come on down to the library auditorium, or you can hear it live here on KCPW. Lots more information at sltrib.com. You can also check out our events page on Facebook. We're talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporters Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, also with us columnist Paul Raleigh. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me this hour, Tribune reporters Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, and columnist Paul Raleigh. And if you've got something to say about the gay marriage appeal or the upcoming legislative session or anything else on your mind, you can send tweets to the hashtag TribTalk. You can put comments at sltrib.com, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. I want to spend a few minutes talking about the same-sex marriage lawsuit. Four Utah gay couples represented by the ACLU are suing the state, claiming that the decision to put gay marriages already performed on hold amounts to a legal limbo, and that's causing them emotional and financial harm. They filed a case this week in state court. They want the state to recognize the marriages, whether or not Amendment 3 is struck down. Paul Raleigh, a convincing case?
Well, we'll see. It's interesting it was filed in state court rather than federal court. On U.S. constitutional issues, which, you know, the whole Amendment 3 was struck, which was the reason it was struck down in the first place. But I believe what they're saying is that these marriages are performed. They were performed legally. They're legal marriages in the state of Utah. And so by the state not recognizing those marriages, they're basically putting these people into second-class status. And I think that's the basis for the suit.
Robert, interestingly, the State Tax Commission has already said that these couples can file jointly, and so are the feds. Right. I'm wondering how popular that concept is with state lawmakers.
Well, it's something the state lawmakers are going to be discussing and looking at this session. There are, I believe, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 mentions of marriage or couples in the state code. And so there are a slew of ramifications, you know, that sort of flow from this. The tax commission is one. Even things like, you know, can you be forced to testify against a spouse? Does that apply, you know, in a criminal case? I mean, you could the sort of the fallout from this could be almost endless, you know. So these are things that they're going to have to work through, and I think the legislature will take it up. I think this case will go a long ways to sort of resolving those issues in the near term, and then obviously we'll look to the Supreme Court for guidance in the long term. But although that's probably, you know, at least a year off before we get that far. So you know, some of these things have to be addressed in the short term, and I think legislators are going to, at least on a piecemeal approach, try to tackle them, you know, one at a time.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about the tax commission ruling is that the ruling, the principle that they're going by is what the legal status was of the marriage on December 31st of that tax year. And so that's what they're going by. So if you were married, if you got married after the judge's ruling, Judge Shelby's ruling, and so that you were considered legally married on December 31st, then that's what, you know, governs the tax commission policy on filing jointly. But now that has been stayed, if there's nothing happens in the appeals courts for a year, the people who could file jointly on December 31st of 2013 won't be able to on December 31st of 2014, because now it's stayed. And I've talked to the governor's office about this, and their view is that so now they're not legally recognized, or, you know, it's back to the way it was before. And so it's almost like the State Tax Commission is divorcing these people. They were married on December 31st of 2013, but won't be on December 31st of 2014.
And hence the lawsuit. Yeah.
And it is interesting because the cutoff does come right in the middle. You had 11 days where people were getting married before the end of the year. Between the beginning of the year and the stay, there was this other group of people that were getting married. Mm-hmm. There's questions about when the licenses were actually processed, and so it does create sort of a bureaucratic mess. There's also a question about people who are married in other states who live here.
Sure.
I talked to one individual who, as soon as Shelby's ruling came out, I mean, he and his spouse were already married, but he went and filed all of his tax returns refiled his tax returns for the past few years, because then they're going to recognize that marriage. So now how do they treat that? That one, I presume, would be treated because he was married before the end of the year.
Right.
That it would be recognized. But that's a question for the tax commission to work through.
A lot of legal questions surrounding one other development in that the case, the appeal by the state, Mr. Gene Scher. He's the outside counsel that the attorney general has selected. This week it was revealed in a goodbye memo to his firm that his decision to take on the marriage case is really grounded in his LDS religious beliefs. And I guess, you know, the reasons why you change jobs aren't really relevant, but the optics of him linking himself so closely to the Mormon church, I mean, they don't really look good. What's right. been the reaction on the Hill, Robert?
I don't know that there's been much reaction on the Hill to that yet. The optics, as you mentioned, were the problem there, because it does, you know, the church has tried to separate itself to some degree from this matter. The attorney general and the governor don't want to make this look like it's a religious crusade, and he couched it very much in those particular terms in this farewell email. You know, and there were already questions about his hiring anyway, because it looks a little bit like he was the choice of the conservative Sutherland Institute, who is going to be it was going to be paying him as to be a fellow at the institute to write policy papers and so forth. And as a result of that, he's been able to cap his fees. The Sutherland isn't actually paying his legal fees to represent the state, but they're sort of augmenting his income while he's doing it. So it's sort of raised some questions in that regard as well. So, but you know, the governor was asked about this yesterday, and the governor said that he thinks, you know, can the real question we need to ask is he qualified? Is he going to do the best job that can be done? And the governor said his credentials are without blemish, and he should be, you know, we should let him go about doing this work he's been hired to do.
And that's a point that was reiterated by Attorney General Sean Reyes. But again. It kind of looks bad. Paul Raleigh?
Well, you know, we had, and I think you're going to see this come up again, this whole religious argument, and you're going to see it from the legislature. And I don't think the church is going to be real happy about these kind of discussions. But we had an op-ed piece from a state senator, Stuart Reed, not long ago in the Tribune. And basically, that was his argument that, I mean, against Judge Shelby's ruling. You know, he was an activist judge, and he was basically saying that Judge Shelby has violated the religious rights of the majority, as though that's the issue, as though that's the argument, rather than the constitutional arguments. There was another legislator, Merrill Nelson, who wrote an op-ed piece in the Deseret News, who I thought gave a more reason, and he's also believes that Judge Shelby's ruling will eventually be overturned, but he gave a more reasoned argument. I mean, he based it more on the law and how we recognize fundamental rights and what constitutes a fundamental right, and what rights the state, basically the states are the ones that have the authority to govern marriages. But the op-ed piece from Stuart Reed, I think is, and I think this is going to fly up again. It's going to show that the argument for some of these people basically is their own religious beliefs that they believe were insulted by Judge Shelby's ruling. And the more that comes up, the more embarrassing it's going to be for, I think, the entire state and the church.
And yesterday at an event hosted by the Sutherland Institute, Senator Reed rolled out three new pieces of legislation. All of them focused on protecting religious liberties, going to the argument that Paul mentioned that he had outlined in that column. So those are bills that are going to be teed up for debate during the legislative session. Are the religious liberties of the predominant faith in this case being trammeled by the judge's ruling? And that's going to be a question, I guess, that is, as Paul notes, will be front and center.
Mm-hmm. I want to move on to another topic, but it deals with religion. One that our listener alluded to, the LDS Church issuing this videotaped statement about the state's liquor laws. For those who haven't seen it, Robert, can you just briefly recap?
Well, yeah. I mean, basically, it was pretty unexpected, but they brought out one of the Quorum of the Twelve, Elder Christofferson, who basically, in the text of the statement and in the video, made the case that Utah's liquor laws now, as they exist now, are working well. We shouldn't kind of cave to this outside pressure that, you know, the perception that Utah's liquor laws are weird or unusual or quirky. And we should, you know, not, the statement itself said that they would be strongly opposed to any changes to Utah's liquor laws in the upcoming session.
You called the statement unusual. I mean, is it unusual in the content? Not
unusual
really?
In that it's not common for the church to publicly take positions on issues before the legislature, and to take them so prominently in the days leading directly up to the legislature.
And I suppose the spokesman, the person who was saying this, is at the top levels of the church.
Right, and yeah, and that was one of the things that was noted by Representative Wilcox, who's been a sponsor of liquor reform legislation in the past, is that, you know, to have one of these apostles come out and give this statement in the way he did is, you know, the only way you can trump that, I guess, is to have the president of the church do it himself. And so, it's a very prominent, very, visible way for them to kind of say, no, we don't want any liquor legislation. Now, that said, I mean, it's far from resolved and settled that there won't be any liquor reform legislation. I mean, Representative Wilcox was sponsoring a bill to do away with the so-called Zion Wall, and this is really the piece of legislation that was teed up for this session. He tried to get rid of it last year, and it failed. He was going to try to get rid of it again.
This is the barrier.
This is the barrier.
It's bars have to put
7-foot tall barrier that restaurants have to have. So they have to prepare drinks on the other side of this wall, so children who are eating at the restaurant can't see the drinks prepared.
Right.
They'll still see them served. They'll still see them consumed, but they won't see them prepared. This is the piece of legislation that this statement appeared to be most focused on, but it's not entirely clear that the statement itself has completely done away with the chances for this passing. I mean, there is a group of people, obviously, that feel like this is, that this wall doesn't serve a practical function, and they're going to continue pushing this. And the League of Cities and Towns now, but a lot of mayors and cities have said, you know, we can't get restaurants to come into our town. So they've joined the fight. You've got restaurants who have been pushing this for years. You've got travel and tourism people who are pushing this. And so really it sets up an opportunity or a possibility, I guess, that the church could get rolled on this in a very public and prominent way.
Well, that's happened before on guns, but Raleigh, you've certainly opined on the state's liquor policies and the LDS church influence on the Hill. What strikes you about this church statement?
Well, I've written a column, my weekend column that'll appear in the Tribune tomorrow, bringing up the question is why was this public statement necessary? Why did the church has always gotten its way on liquor legislation? The church always weighs in on liquor legislation. There is no liquor legislation that is passed in the state of Utah without the church's approval, but it's always been done behind the scenes. It's always been done privately. I wrote in my column Saturday, I mentioned something that happened back in the 80s when there was a bill to give exemptions on the open carry law to limousines and fun buses where people could drink in the back of the limousine or the back of the fun buses that are hired to take them. And it had no opposition whatsoever. There was not one vocal opposition in the committees or anything. It sailed through the House. It sat in the Rules Committee in the Senate for a while, but then it came out, was put on the board. Nobody ever publicly opposed the bill. The Bangor administration supported it. Law enforcement supported it because it put the drunks in the back seat rather than behind the wheel of hired vehicles. And on the last night of the session, when it was on the board, two senators got calls from the church saying the church didn't want it to pass. Two senators, Senate president and then one other senator. One of the senators got up and made a motion to circle the bill. The Senate president basically said all in favor, and then he said it's passed. So they circled the bill. He never recognized anybody else who tried to uncircle it. The bill was killed by two senators because they got a call from the church.
Okay, so to answer your question, why? Why would the church do this extra measure?
Right, it's a good question because, like I say, the church always gets its way on liquor legislation. So if the church wants the status quo, the church will get the status quo. The speculation is that there's kind of a new breed of legislators like Representative Wilcox. And I remember last year at a committee meeting when they were talking about, you know, Derrick Brown, who's now left, but he represents this new breed of young Republican legislators. He actually asked the question, why is the state of Utah in the business of selling liquor? It should be a private sector issue. And so I believe that this was aimed more at the constituents of the Republican legislators, you know, just coming out and saying, you know, to the public, this is the stand of the church, which will now put more pressure on the legislature to, you know, keep in line.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think Paul hit it on the head because, I mean, it's easy, as he mentioned, the church has always made its position clear to legislators quietly, you know, in private meetings or in private communication that they don't oppose or they don't support this sort of reform. To do it this publicly, you're not speaking to the legislators at that point. You're speaking to the people who elect them And I think in an election year, they thought that they could put more pressure on the legislators this way than by having these one-on-one conversations that they've had in the past to communicate these ideas.
Mm. Very quickly, I want to switch gears. Our colleague Tom Harvey reported this week on Jeremy Johnson's mm-hmm. statement in court. Of course, he's the pal of former Attorney General John Swallow. Mm. He's now claiming that Swallow and the feds essentially ganged up on him in trumped up charges. Robert, can you fill in the blanks?
Yeah, I mean, what it boils down to is that Jeremy believes that the former Attorney General Swallow, who was, I guess, chief deputy at the time, and the prosecutor in his case, Brent Ward, conspired to have him locked up. Jeremy was arrested when he was going down to Costa Rica to visit his family, and he was taken into custody. And he contends that they had him arrested and then decided to build the case sort of after the fact, that Brent Ward has kind of built this criminal case after he's already been filed the charges. And so they don't think he has a case to present. So they're asking the judge to sort of accelerate this thing, bring it to trial and put this thing to rest because they don't think the state or the federal prosecutors can prove their case. Yeah. Brent Ward has since, he's no longer on the case. He was, you know, he was removed from it, I guess, just shortly before he decided he was going to run for Attorney General, which was short-lived. And but so they're trying to get this thing headed to trial quicker rather than, you know, having it's dragged on for a long time at this point.
And before we go to another break, is there any movement on the Swallow investigations? Any updates we need to know about?
Very little at this point. We're kind of waiting for the House Investigative Committee's report. You know, the investigation by the county attorneys is proceeding, but from what everything I hear, it's kind of entered a quiet phase of sorts, you know, where they're trying to, they issued this flurry of search warrants and now they've collected that information and are kind of trying to sift through it and figure out their next step, I guess.
Mm. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Robert Gerke, also with us, Brian Maffley, and columnist Paul Raleigh. We need to take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Joining me in studio, Salt Lake Tribune reporters Robert Gerke, Brian Maffley, and columnist Paul Raleigh. Before we get to your picks for the underplayed story of the week, we're on the eve of the legislative session. Maybe each of you, can you just highlight a quick bill that you think is going to gain some traction? Brian?
I think the one I think will be the most interesting on my beat, environment, is the one that Becky Edwards is proposing. Let's take the shackles off the state environmental regulators. I think it's a measure that would resonate with a lot of Republicans because it will allow our people to develop rules that are relevant to Utah.
Mm. It's all about the state knowing best. And
yeah.
Becky Edwards' air quality bill. Robert, what do you got?
I'd say probably two bills that are sort of opposite sides of the same coin. And one is Senator Steve Urquhart's non-discrimination bill, which has been before the legislature in the past, but it's got a Republican sponsor this time. He's done a lot of work on trying to build up a coalition to pass this thing. The flip side of that is as we mentioned, the Senator Stuart Reed's bills on religious freedoms, and they're all kind of going at this issue of gay rights and in the wake of the Shelby ruling in very different ways. And so it's going to set up a stark contrast between and a clear choice, I guess, for senators and representatives to make on that.
Hmm. Paul Raleigh, what bills are you watching?
Well, transportation, I think, is going to be a big deal on how to, increase mass transportation, put more money into those areas. Like we talked about earlier, it's an election year, so it's very difficult to get any kind of tax increase or revenue increase during an election year. And like Robert mentioned before, they'll hoist it off. If they do anything at all, it'll be this local option where they can blame it on the local officials rather than themselves. Robert mentioned the Senator Urquhart's bill. That's going to get a lot of attention because that's gotten the attention of the Eagle Forum and the right wing, and there's already a big pushback against that bill. Gail Ruzicka, the president of the Eagle Forum, actually had an op-ed piece where she said this will create a situation where boys and girls will shower together in schools and things like that. And you're going to see a lot of silliness like that come up. And of course, there will be legislators who will make that argument because it's the Eagle Forum. But that'll be – watch a bit of a circus on that bill coming up.
One more to put on the radar, I guess, is Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City are going to be looking for subsidies from the state, tax breaks for a conventions hotel downtown. This fell just short last session, and they've been
working. It's like one or two votes, right?
Yeah, and they've been working it really hard over the past year, and I think they might have the momentum to get that through this year.
Okay, underplayed story of the week, Paul.
Well, I would say I actually said something in my column today about this, but you know, with the Sundance Film Festival, you've got the outdoor marketers in town, these big conventions. I don't think most people coming in from out of state know that when they go into a bar in Utah, they have to show their if they look 35 or younger, they have to show their license plate and it's scanned. And I don't think most people know that the bars have to keep that information on hand for 5 days. Some states have your social security numbers on your driver's license. So you basically given over all the information somebody needs for identity theft. And the bars don't have to tell people that they keep this information for 5 days, and most of them don't tell them. Mm. So that's the one I think is kind of an underplayed issue.
I like it. Robert.
I don't know if this one's underplayed. I've mentioned it before, but this insemination clinic up at the University
the
of Utah.
Witch. It even has its own hashtag now.
And it's remarkable, I guess, this week the university said they're going to be launching their investigation into it. And I said I believe that there could be as many as 1,000 cases where this could have taken place. And so this thing just seems to be sort of building, and it's a fascinating story and one that I'm a little surprised hasn't gotten more national attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Brian?
Well, Robert trumped me. I agree with Robert on that. That's a fascinating story, and the reporter who broke it, Matthew Piper, he reminded me yesterday that he found a story I wrote about this situation back in the 90s where a couple had sued this clinic over a mix-up of their semen. So it appears back at that time, it appeared maybe it was an innocent mistake. Now we know that maybe it wasn't. There was some deliberate manipulation of the semen now, and now it could have been affecting not just one family, but possibly hundreds.
That's stomach turning. My pick is the debate over adoption in Utah. A group of fathers got together this week. They're suing the state of Utah, saying that state laws sort of cut them out of the loop for parental rights. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that. We got to go. Brian Maffley, Robert Gerke, Paul Raleigh of the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We'll wrap up this hour with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. In 2005, he wrote about how he loathes barbershop quartet music. And boy, did barbershop music fans give him an earful.
Barbershop music, after they held their international convention of the Barbershop Harmony Society. And it proves what I've said before, that you can sort of make a religion or a sacred cow out of anything and then defend it with the worst kind of behavior.
Your hatred sort of stems from a neighbor.
Yeah, we lived next to a guy who sang all the time, and he was sang in a barbershop quartet, and he was really annoying because when you only get one of the four, it doesn't harmonize very well.
Do you want to read a section of the column?
Sure. When I was growing up, one of the neighbors sang in a quartet. Nothing wrong with that, mind you, but he practiced at home by himself. Mr. Hobbs sang while he mowed the yard, worked on his car, and just sat on the porch. Cats became mentally ill, and birds flew around rather than over his house. So what I got was an appreciation for barbershop from one quarter of the quartet. I have no idea which part Mr. Hobbs sang, but it was definitely the more irritating of the four. If he's still alive somewhere, Mr. Hobbs probably has no idea how many times he came close to getting shot in the neck with a Daisy air rifle.
Oh, my. So this really grates on your nerves, this kind of music. And then, as you alluded to, it got a very strong and vocal response.
Well, I probably would have ignored this particular subject altogether, but during the time that their convention was in, the Tribune started getting emails from people who didn't appreciate the fact that these people broke into song no matter where they were. They sang on tracks, in the corners, in clubs, in bars. And the sense is that they thought people would appreciate it every bit as much as they did. And so in response to those emails, I wrote this column. And it generated a huge and vicious feedback. The column got posted on a number of barbershop websites, and I got thousands of emails about it. That Channel 2 showed up in my yard to interview me about the complaints that the mayor's office was getting about this, and it went on for quite a while.
And the mayor even asked for an apology?
No, one of the mayor's... one of the people in charge of the Salt Lake City Convention Bureau tried to get me to make nice with them. By then, it was a little bit beyond that. I always thought it was ironic that people who sang about apple pie and mom and the flag could turn out to be really insulting at the same time. And so I said I wasn't really interested in making up with them. I was willing to let us both go our own ways.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read his columns at sltrib.com, and you can hear him each week here on Behind the Headlines. A quick reminder again, join us for a town hall meeting, Cleaning Up Utah's Air. That's happening next Wednesday, January 29th at 7 o'clock here at the City Library. We'll have a panel of experts on hand to look at practical solutions all the way from the individual up to the highest levels. Bryce Bird, Denitsa Blagev, Carrie Kelly, Sean Tigern from the Utah Foundation, all taking your questions. So we hope that you can tune in on KCPW or come down to the City Library. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, the show produced by the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thanks for listening.